I'm Jane Johnson, and you're listening to the Careering into Motherhood podcast, a series of insightful interviews with real women who tell their real life stories as working mothers. We don't preach, we definitely don't have all the answers, but we do offer different perspectives. For details about all the other support we offer, please visit www.careeringintomotherhood.com. My guest today is Dr. Anice Mukherjee, author of the brand new book, The Complete Guide to the Menopause, your toolkit to take control and achieve lifelong health, something that sounds very interesting, I'm sure we'll all agree. Before I start, I want to just mention that I had a technical glitch. It was always going to happen after a year of recording the podcast from home. It's right towards the end and it's only very slight, but you might notice a bit of a change in the sound in one of the microphones. But I just felt the content that Dr. Anice talks about was too important to leave on the cutting floor and not share with you. Dr. Anice Mukherjee is a clinician and top hormone consultant who went through the menopause herself at the age of 41 following a breast cancer diagnosis. She and I talk about this and what brought her to write this book, which frankly is the menopause Bible that I have been waiting for, and I'm sure many other women. If you're not quite there at the menopause or entering the menopause yet, Dr. Anice's advice is still use this book to prepare yourself, because forewarned is forearmed. She's not an advocate of only using management tools like HRT. Instead, she talks about a number of what she calls biohacks to tackle the most difficult symptoms, whether that's through diet, exercise, lifestyle, and the all-important nutrients, which we'll come on to talk about. Forget self-care, meaning massage and manicures. This is self-care at its most important.
I ended up making a big decision to leave my sort of day job, my conventional job, having the backup of my private work to fund me. And then actually, really, my passion is to get things out on a wider scale. I want to change the narrative. I want to help make midlife magnificent. And it sounds cliched, but midlife at the moment is not portrayed very well. And actually, everything about seniority in our world is men. We need more women there, not just in the workplace, but that is really important. But, you know, just in families and social settings, I want women to be confident and to be contributing. And you know, the senior leaders in our world, 30% at best women, 70% men, women get overtaken around that midlife phase. And that needs to change, and it needs to change in three ways, really. The woman herself needs to be empowered. We need to make tweaks in the employment sector to support women when they need it. And not everyone needs support, but many women need tiny amounts of support here and there, make a huge difference. In the healthcare sector, the women who need help need the help, and they're not getting it. That they're paying to see private doctors, and that's a postcode lottery, or if you know you're lucky enough to find the right person. But actually, what I really want is for this to not be a postcode lottery. Every single woman gets, if she needs help, gets the help she needs. So that's kind of, and so the book was my launching board for shouting about it and getting on, you know, here with you and talking about it, which is brilliant.
I feel equally as passionately. I think, so I was an older mum. I had my son when I was 40, and a geriatric mum, as I was termed.
Everyone is now, aren't they?
This is the thing, I think, as well, because I had stayed longer in my career and having been to university and so on and so forth. I don't know if I consciously put off having children, but I didn't have them until later. And I'm not unusual, as you say, everyone is now. And then pretty shortly after he was born, I just felt strange. I mean, I was well recovered from a cesarean, but I was well recovered from that and everything. But I just knew things were changing. And my friend said, oh, go and see your doctor. And I think they just took one look at me and went, well, maybe. And then I went back and I was talking to another friend and I said, I still don't feel right. I know there's something wrong. And she's like, oh, go back to the same surgery, but ask to see this particular doctor. And she seemed to know a lot more, and she sent me for a blood test and so on. But it's still been inconclusive. And as you say, it just seems such a postcode lottery. And And I just know there's so much more I can do. So I personally, and that's why I loved reading your book when you talk about the nutritional table and things that you've got, the dietary, not supplements, but we'll come on to talk about what you recommend, and the exercise. We started strength training and all that kind of thing. But it, for me, a completely non-clinical person, non-clinician, it's just been trial and error.
Yeah. And I think in the early chapters, I do talk about this, you exemplify the sandwich generation. You're there, you've had kids later, so you're juggling kids, trying to carry on with your career and develop your career, and there's just a lot going on, and the world is more connected, the world is different from 3 decades ago, and I've seen that in how different health conditions manifest in my patients. And we have to take into consideration that we're all spending hours on sitting down compared to being outside, on social media, looking at blue light screens all day and then late into the evening, which affects your sleep, doing less exercise. The food quality that we're getting is often not as good as we think. And I know that in the NHS, they always say, if you've got a balanced diet, you don't need to take supplements. And I don't agree with that, because of mass farming and soil depletion and, globalization, what protein and fat is in the food because they write it all down. But actually, in your one ingredient foods and your fruit and your vegetables and your nuts, you don't know what micronutrient quality are in those foods. You think an apple a day, is supposed, they used to say an apple a day keeps the doctor away. But actually, the micronutrients in one apple today is far less than it was 80 years ago. So that's possibly why they're saying now, instead of 5 a day, you need 7 a day, of your fruit and veg, because you don't get those micronutrients. So there's so many different things. But actually, in many ways, because it's multidimensional, if you use sort of synergistic approaches, which I talk about in my toolkit in my book, you can make small changes in lots of different aspects of your life, which has a very big difference. And I've seen it work again and again for the women I've seen in menopause and in other health conditions. But the problem is, in terms of your GP or a doctor seeing you, is that every single woman is different. Everyone's story, everyone's narrative is different. So some people suffer more with sleep. Some people suffer more with muscular aches and pains, or, physical activity is harder. Everybody's got different challenges in their lives. So you do have to understand your own body. That is, you can't just go to your doctor and say, I feel dreadful, and expect them to solve it. I mean, I do try to, but I spend a lot longer with my patients than a GP has in their clinics, as you know. So they've got about 5 minutes, I think. So yeah, I mean, I think having kids later is one major thing that is different today. And you're looking after your kids forever these days. I've got kids at home at the moment, university from home.
So true. But so let's just go back to the basics a little bit. So if you talk about your background and how you came to be a clinical specialist in women and menopause.
Yes. Yeah, so my background is endocrinology, which a lot of people haven't heard the term, but it just essentially means a hormone specialist. So after I did my general medical training, which is to be a hospital doctor, in the early 1990s, I decided to specialise in endocrinology. So endocrinology is a small specialty, really. It has basically two arms. There's diabetes, which we all train in. And then some of us then super specialise in the endocrinology side, which is hormones. So the hormone glands, other than diabetes and the pancreas, are things like the thyroid gland, the gonads, the pituitary gland in the brain, and the adrenal glands. And there are some other rare conditions that we look after, but we all do all of it. And so I trained at King's College London, where I did sort of every aspect of endocrinology during that training. But then I went on to do research at the Christie Hospital in Manchester, which is a cancer hospital. And I worked in the endocrine unit. And so I looked after many women who'd gone through an early menopause because of cancer treatment, chemotherapy that can damage the gonads, and also many patients who had damage to their pituitary gland, which is the master hormone gland in the brain that controls all the hormones in the body. So I learned a lot about, managing menopause in younger women. And, I was doing all of this at the time when the Women's Health Initiative study was published. So that's the study that gave HRT, you know, the bad name. Oh, you know, it stopped. HRT is evil. And me and my colleagues, we didn't really bat an eyelid. We were like, well, you know, you're not going to stop hormone treatment in a younger woman who really, really needs it. And we very much studied the subgroup analysis. And it's very clear that you can predict safety with HRT. So I trained in that. And fast forward, you know, 20 years, I've just had more and more interest in women's health. I look after all sorts of hormone conditions in women, not just menopause, but thyroid problems are much more common in women. Other reproductive endocrine problems like polycystic ovarian syndrome and premenstrual disorders. So I have an interest in women's health. And, you know, I look after women, you know, over many years and see how their careers are going and how their lives are going and how their menopause progresses. And what's right for somebody in terms of their hormone balance at one stage in their life can be different at another stage, you know, and pregnancy can change things. You know, you can, it's almost sometimes reboots the system. It can make things better. It can make things worse. Yeah. So I think my specific slant on it happened when I developed breast cancer in 2011. And I had two separate cancers, and I was told, because they were they're called early stage breast cancer, but I was very young, I was only 41, and it was early stage, and so they said, oh, you don't need chemotherapy. And I, all of my knowledge from actually having worked in oncology when in my junior doctor days, thought, oh, I'd really rather be belt and braces here. I'm not, you know, I don't really want to risk having lots of estrogen in my system when I've got very strongly estrogen positive breast cancer. So, and early stage breast cancers can be deceiving because they can look like they're not a problem and then they come back 5-10 years later. So they're tricky because they look like they're not as serious. But, you know, I talk about Olivia Newton-John, you know, hers came back 26 years later, I think, something like that. So, you know, you do need to be careful about how you manage it. So I with my team, my oncology and breast surgeon team, I had a chemical menopause at that stage in my life with injections.
You sort of induce a menopause, is that right?
You induce it. And many, many younger women have to have that done for breast cancer because you need to starve any breast cancer cells that are left. So for me, it was a no-brainer because I did have a fair bit of knowledge, luckily. And the thing for me is that it was okay. And then I see so many women suffering and I'm thinking, no, you should not be suffering. And for many women, and I've got a particular scenario because I wouldn't take HRT because I don't want to expose my body to estrogen. But most women can take HRT very safely, and it's great. You know, I'm not at all anti-HRT. Use what helps you, but you have to use multiple sort of synergistic methods to optimize your well-being in menopause. Do not try and put your eggs all your eggs in one basket. So there's no point in saying I'm going to, you know, just focus on my sleep and I'm going to do everything to improve my sleep. And 3 weeks later, you think my sleep is better, but everything else in my life is awful, you know, because you've got to address the exercise and the nutrition and everything else as well.
And I think that's why your book is so good, because you do chapter by chapter, you provide comprehensive information that people can then pick and choose. And I have to be honest, you know, I'm going through it and I'm thinking, I wish I could almost make notes on your notes. And think, okay, well, I might try this and then try that. And, you know, I think you very cleverly provided, you know, options to be able to blend and try different things and see what works.
You know, you can use it as a flexible tool. And actually, if you go back to it in a year, you might have solved one thing and then be more focused on another bit. So that's why hopefully, you know, it's not just different people's perspective, but for the same people at different times in their lives as well.
Yes. And so I'm interested in this in terms of over what period of time, and again, I guess you're probably going to say because everyone is so different, is how long is a piece of string, but just broadly speaking, how long would you typically anticipate a woman to be experiencing symptoms or need to be managing their health?
Well, I would say that the most difficult symptoms usually come earlier in the menopause or perimenopause journey. Yeah. So the mistake is to say, I'm going to put up with the symptoms until they're really bad. And then I'm going to throw everything at it. Because it's like with anything in life, if you leave it, it's like a house. If you don't look after your house, and then you say, I've got to refit, it's going to take an awful lot more work to try and get it back up to scratch. So with your body, if you're in a terrible state, if you then take HRT, it's probably not going to do anything because you've got to address so many more things. So the key is keeping ahead of the game. And that's why most menopause specialists will say, you know, if you're really struggling, try HRT earlier. It's also much safer when you're younger anyway. Don't put it off. But if you don't want to go down the HRT route, that's also fine. But implement all the other treatment modalities that you can do for yourself that I talk about in the book, which are, you know, things like sleep and exercise. Exercise, I mean, for me, exercise is the most important thing. And it's the first chapter in my toolkit. And it's probably the thing that is the biggest problem in today's society, because we are all sitting at work, we are all sitting at home, we're on devices. Now we're all locked down. And actually, that's not an excuse, because the government are saying we can go outside. And I always say, if it's raining, it doesn't matter. I love the sunshine and I will go out. In fact, last night it was snowing and I went out at, I think, 9 or 10 o'clock at night for a walk in the snow. I didn't have time yesterday because I'm, you know, with work, it's difficult for me too. I'm not in an ivory tower saying my life is perfect. You know, I am sitting here working at my desk, but I'm just super aware that my body needs fresh air. It needs exercise. And so I prioritize those things. And prioritizing is important, because the other thing about women, and particularly women in midlife, is because they've got lots of challenges, they do not prioritize themselves. And if you don't prioritize yourself, you think you're doing the right thing by just trying to look after everyone and do everything. But actually, you can't do everything for everyone if you're not looking after yourself. So, I mean, I see that with myself. You know, I can be better with my family if I'm feeling good myself. And if I'm, you know, not doing my exercise or if not sleeping, I'm going to be grumpy, you know, whether, you know, even if I was on HRT, you know, if you're not getting your sleep or if you're not burning off excess stress. I mean, stress is a big toxic problem in our modern world because it's chronic, especially this last year. I wrote the book before the pandemic, so there's not a mention of pandemic in the book, but I do talk about stress a lot.
Yes, but I'm quite interested in, you do in the stress section, as it were, of your toolkit, and fatigue and this idea of sleep and everything, and just talked upon at the very start, this idea, especially right now, and I know for a fact our listeners, you know, mostly working mums, or we're almost at breaking point. I've just handed over the baton to my husband, the baton being a six-year-old child, and come up here to record this. And, you know, it just seems there's absolutely no 9 to 5 anymore. And how much of that, I suppose, is just this is what everyone is going through right now, versus I personally just know I'm so much more impacted, I guess, by stressful situations. I feel so much more exhausted because I'm sure it's perimenopause or the actual menopause.
Yes, and all the problem is the human body is so complicated, and all the different types of hormones, including your female hormones in men, male hormones, and the stress hormones all interact with each other. And the problem in our modern world, and worse so obviously in the last year, is that we're meant to have a sort of circadian rhythm and or trading rhythm. We're meant to have body clocks for hormone production for many of our hormones. And the stress hormones should be produced very highest level in the morning, and they should be at their very lowest at night. And they will peak and trough through the day. Like, for example, now we're doing this recording, your and my cortisol should be a little bit higher, just ready for the, you know, the work, you know, the challenges of it. But then they'll dip back down again. When stress becomes relentless, there is an imbalance in the cortisol levels. And that's not an adrenal disease. And my esteemed endocrinology colleagues would say there's no such, it's not a disease. Chronic stress is not an endocrine disease, because it's not a problem with the adrenals. It's a secondary phenomenon because of lifestyles and the way our stress is in the modern world. So what happens is your cortisol is not quite fit for purpose in the morning when you wake up. So you wake up unrefreshed and you think, really, is it morning? Because your cortisol may be like where it should be at 3 a.m. And then when you go to bed at night, it's not low enough because you're wired all day. So you go to bed sort of tired and wired. Your cortisols aren't, you know, peaking and troughing where they need to be. And high cortisol at night disrupts your sleep, and then your sleep becomes fragmented. I think there's quite a bit of research on COVID and sleep fragmentation coming through at the moment. But yeah, so a lot of people are struggling with sleep more during the pandemic. And that is partly because of just the chronic stress. And some of my patients say, but I don't feel, because actually it's easier, I'm working from home now, I shouldn't. But the problem is, you don't think psychologically you're stressed, but we're completely out of our normal world. We're living in a parallel universe. We're working from home, or living at work, as I think Roman Chatterjee had said, described it as, we're living at work. You know, there is no escape. As you said, you know, there isn't a 9 to 5. So that really impacts on sleep quality and fatigue. And that's most people. But then there are many other individual factors when it comes to fatigue. And I have had a huge interest in fatigue through my career, again, for probably 25 years. And I've led our regional fatigue service when I worked in the NHS. So I am really good at homing in on it. But you have to find it's the exact triggers and factors that are driving it are different for everybody. Because the thing is, our instincts are from our genes, and our instincts will say, you're tired, so you better not go and do that walk because you're too tired, or not go and do the gym, or, you know, sit on the sofa rather than do any movement. And actually, a lot of people try and sleep for longer because they feel tired. But if your sleep quality is not good, that doesn't solve the problem. So some of our coping strategies that we automatically do, which are born out from our instincts, actually can make things like fatigue worse. And then obviously, if you're very stressed, the other thing that I just notice, and it's not particular, I mean, there are some data coming through, but it's just something that I observe, people who are under chronic stress seem to very frequently have borderline low levels of all the super micronutrients that help with well-being, like the B vitamins that help with your brain focus, and, you know, the zinc that helps with your immune system, vitamin D. And so if you're a bit low on all of those, it'll impact on your energy levels. And none of the things I've talked about on their own are the whole story in any one person, because the human body is complicated. It's not binary. It's not on off, or looking at any number of different factors that you yourself can modify can make a really sizable difference going forward.
So are things like the micronutrients that you talk about, and when you exercise, or just making sure you fit exercise in each day, those will have a knock-on effect. If you're going through the menopause and your cortisol levels and all these things are completely out of kilter, you believe that they can be ticked up, or they can be adjusted through the micronutrients and lifestyle choices.
Yeah, and exercise is absolutely brilliant at sort of balancing stress hormones. It's really, really good. And that can be a problem if you don't do exercise. Starting out on exercise, if you do too much, you effectively get a scenario where you're overtraining. And so that can actually make things worse. So you have to do the right amount. But if you do a workout that's a good workout for you, what that will do is it'll give you a little bit of a peak of stress hormones while you're doing the exercise. That's what normally happens. And then you get a sort of a trough of the stress hormones and a rise in the feel-good hormones, the endorphins and the neurotransmitters that make you feel good afterwards. A lot of people, when they get the right amount of exercise for them, feel really good after the exercise. And that you want to bottle that. I mean, if you can bottle that and have that all of the time, that works really well. But what sometimes, again, this is an instinctive thing, is that people go, right, I know exercise is it, so I'm going to go and do a marathon. Mm-hmm. They haven't done, you know, a 5-minute walk. And then you overdo it, and then you get an injury, or you just think, that was awful, I'm never doing that again. So you kind of shoot yourself in the foot, essentially.
Love it. I love all this stuff. So I when I started, I left my PAYE job and I launched my own business after my son was born. And I was literally dropping him at nursery, coming back, working, going to collect him, putting him to bed, and then just working again all through the night. And I got really sick and ended up in hospital with a kidney infection a few years ago. And in that, as horrible as that particular time was, it kickstarted me into thinking, God, I literally had fallen off the wagon completely in terms of doing any exercise for about 5 years. And I just thought, this, I can't continue like that. And I think, as I said, I'm very fortunate to have found these amazing women who do personal training, and now we do it via Zoom in the garden at all sorts of crazy times. But if I hadn't, I don't know what else would have brought me back to exercise. And I feel so grateful because I think it happened at just the right time. And I absolutely feel now if I haven't done anything for a couple of days, and believe me, I'm no sort of like woman or anything like that, but if I haven't done my training, I can feel it in my head. It's really weird. I can feel
it. Absolutely. And it's no coincidence you got an infection, because when you're running on chronic stress, it suppresses your immune system. So it's not a good combination. And then the other thing about what you said about that situation in employment, and this is where we need to look at employment and we need to look at how big employers are treating their workforces, is that, you know, when you're in employment and you're working and think you've got a deadline and another deadline and another deadline, and you're working through lunch and then you're working in the evenings, essentially you just become less productive. And I think all the big multinationals, certainly in the United States, they're ahead of the game. They know that if they look after their workforce, if they allow their workforce to have a break at lunchtime, if they, you know, help their workforce to with well-being programs to understand well-being, productivity skyrockets, sickness absence shoots through the floor. But actually, we are quite behind in the UK, and there is still, and I think this is also borne out by the fact that 70% plus of senior roles in all industry and business, etc., are men. And it's that macho mentality. Just keep going, have the 6 o'clock breakfast meeting. You've got to, oh, we need a 9 o'clock, 9 p.m. evening meeting. You know, it's that mentality. And it's changing. And so it should, because it's stifling productivity and innovation, I believe, rather than encouraging it. And we need to make changes in many different approaches to employment. And that's everything. But certainly women who are heading into menopause and going through the menopause, it's the fastest growing demographic in the workplace. Yes, it's huge, you know, and in the last 30 years, the number of women who are employed in menopause has gone up by 50%. So we have to address this, because otherwise we're just going to have a heap of menopausal women going, this is all awful and my life is terrible. And that's what I can kind of see that could possibly happen. And I don't want that to happen.
No, and I know in your book, on when you have a whole section on menopause at work, and I again really encourage our listeners to go and get a copy, because as you say, ironically, just as women, you know, we fought so hard, women are slowly inching up to more senior positions and staying there, but you just get, you know, the plum job, and then the menopause comes along and you're all of a sudden you're so exhausted, you can't get up, you know, the stress and so on and so forth. But you are at great pains in your book to say, you know, we shouldn't be treating the menopause as an illness. It's definitely not that.
No, but we need to support women through that phase, because we haven't got balance of leadership, certainly in the UK. Women get to that stage, they've got a huge amount of experience and knowledge. We start off ahead of men, or ahead of boys at school, and then at university, and then in early careers. And then, you know, at menopause, women in senior roles just disappear. And actually, that doesn't make for a balanced society. We need society to be more balanced. We need women in senior roles. And I'm not telling the women who are listening, if they're not working, I'm not telling them they've got to go work. But I think if they want, you know, if that has been their drive, and then menopause stops that, then we've got to change that situation. And it's not just at work, it's in social settings. It's just in contentment in relationships, in family settings. We need women to be, you know, more contented and healthier and happier through that phase of life. So, because it's a long phase as well. We live as long, most women have more adult life after menopause than they have adult life before menopause. So it matters. It really matters.
Yes. You talk about how your book is, I think it's the only kind of clinical research-based toolkit on the market for women that talks about the menopause. And as you say, that I think a lot of women don't want to raise it. I mean, I'd have been mortified at the thought of having to talk to my boss about, you know, just being so exhausted I couldn't come in one day or something. And why is there such a taboo around the menopause, which there isn't around pregnancy?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just the culture needs to change. It's the culture. A woman shouldn't have to go and say, you know, I'm struggling with menopause. What needs to be happening is that workplaces and employers should have menopause awareness programs for their managers and for their you know, the HR and the senior people, and these should be also provided to employees. So I've done a few of these to some of the larger employers. And actually, some of them, initially, before I've done the sort of presentation, you can see the HR can get a little bit twitchy and go, oh, what's she going to talk? Is she going to say, you know, it's an illness and we've got to look after it? And actually, they've loved it. They've said, actually, this is fantastic. We know what we need to do. It's really simple, small little tweaks to support women. And actually, it shouldn't be about naming and shaming you. It should be every woman in menopause, you know, we need to be aware that, you know, just simple things like providing desk fans, you know, if you haven't got air conditioning in your office or whatever, and providing time for in meetings if you're going to have a hot flush or something like that, or you know, you're worried about having a hot flush. There should be just little options to minimize those awful moments where you've got sweat dripping down your nose and you're trying to give a presentation or something like that. And there's loads and loads of small things that can be done in the workplace. And it's also about, you know, women knowing what their options are and knowing that they can ask for help if they need to. I'm not saying menopause is an illness, but some women do need extra support, you know, multifaceted support for lots of different reasons, because lives are complicated and it's not just about the single hormone issue. It can be about wider aspects of health as well. I mean, you know, another thing is if you look at women today who are going through menopause, 62% of women today going through menopause are either overweight or obese clinically. And that's very, very significantly higher than it was 3 decades ago when I started. You know, weight management difficulties add another dimension to menopause symptoms and can impact on things like hot flushes and other symptoms. So that's why I have a weight management chapter in my book, because that's tough. When you get to menopause, it's bad enough having menopause symptoms and, you know, you find that your metabolism isn't quite as robust, and then it's easier to gain weight, and then you can be in a situation where your weight is going up and you're not feeling as well, and that can affect your confidence in the workplace, you know, and all sorts of things. So there's lots of different factors, and many factors can be helped by a supportive employer. So I don't think it's about women approaching their employer. I think it's about the employers changing their culture. It's not a book all about employment, but I wanted to put it out there because it ties in with my passion that I want to keep. If women want to be in work, I don't want them to feel they've got to leave work because of menopause. And there is definitely evidence to show that women, for example, the severity of hot flushes links with women's intention to leave the workforce. And that can be all levels of seniority. Mm. Yes. Yeah.
It's fascinating. And I can't recommend your book highly enough. And thank you for writing it as well, because it's educational, informative, and obviously there's a bit of a social drum banging as well. So thank you very much. And thank you for your time today.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you very much for having me and letting me talk about it. I know I talk an awful lot, so you've probably struggled to get a word in edgeways, but I hope the recording's
right. Don't be silly, not at all. And also, sorry, I should say, obviously, we'll put the link to your book in our show notes, but where else can people find out about you?
Yes, I'm on Instagram and Facebook as @thehormonedoc, and I do have a website, and Penguin are doing a fair bit of publicity, I think, but anyone can order my book through links on my website or on my social media feeds. And I hope everyone finds, I just want really to help empower women, and I want to empower women before they get into menopause. I want them to start thinking about it and prepare for it, because then it won't be as bad and they will be able to seamlessly continue with their life, whatever they choose, you know, in terms of family, employment and everything. So thank you for having me.
My thanks to Dr. Anise. We'll be running an online event with her at the start of March, so if you'd like to come along, it will be online, but please drop me an email, jane@careeringintomotherhood.com, and I'll put your name on the list, as they say. And don't forget, you can find out more about all of our events and coaching support that we offer via Careering Into Motherhood, our Facebook group, and the website. I don't use this podcast to promote or sell things, but I honestly can't recommend that book highly enough. Please get yourself a copy or get one for your friend. It'll be the kindest thing you can do. And if for nothing else, it's just incredibly interesting. Please don't forget to like and leave a review. It's so important and really helps. And if nothing else, it's also great to just hear your comments on the podcast. But otherwise, until next time.